assumptions, you don't know. That's why we have a project. Steve, one more.
You're not gonna even identify the need for rework when you start a project. It's gonna be 1%, 5% into the project before you're even doing quality checks to the point where you say, okay, we need to do rework on this.
Right, right. That's a good point, and we'll come back to that when we talk about monitoring and forecasting. You're not gonna be able to identify specific rework at the beginning of the project. The question is, can you identify that there's going to be rework? You may not know what it is, and so hold that thought. All right, so something happens, and then it evolves over the course of the project. Hopefully, as you learn, you improve your quality, and you'll get to the end. I think you might get back from my pen. How do I do the mouse pen? Laser pointer. I don't know. What is it? Oh, that works very well. Hopefully you finish at the scheduled completion date. But as we'll see, there can be other dynamics. Errors may propagate more than you thought. Teams may fail to coordinate. You might be doing firefighting at the end to resolve problems, and the project slips beyond the end. The quality of delivery is when you ship. Is it here? If it is, here you're shipping a product with lots of defects. If you wait until out here, defects go away, but you're late, and it probably costs more. Yes?
You consider the quality going up even though you de-scope some items at the end and you're like, can't do this anymore, this is not working. Does the graph still go up?
The graph would still go up because de-scoping is affecting the performance grade aspect of it. Although there are some, but we'll come back to that. But that's my initial answer. Okay. So how do we get to that endpoint? The difficulty of it and the cost of achieving the scope, the performance, the grade you want with acceptable remaining defects depends on lots of things. Your decisions impacting what you're going to do, the scope, the target requirements, the capabilities you are trying to develop versus what you have. Uncertainties and risks, how much technical innovation do we need? Organization culture, are you a aggressive, get it done as fast as possible organization, or are you maybe a quality first organization, whatever the difference between those is, and we'll get to that. How much resources you have versus those you need? Do you have a feasible plan? And then project dynamics. Project design for quality addresses how the organization is going to handle all of those factors. Starting with scope and requirements, which is where we typically started it when you go back to SAA and SE. How do you decide what the scope, what the grade, what the requirements are? And I'm not going to go into that today. You've spent lots of time, I believe, as you have in prior years, in SE and SA on just that topic. But there are some things that are important from a project management standpoint. The scope and requirements that you choose, to the extent they impact the difficulty of achieving the capabilities, the amount of effort you need, to the extent they are difficult and a stretch, they're going to affect the cost of achieving quality. And therefore, that should feed back in your, from your project plans to scope decisions. Back to the design for capability discussion we had, I guess, a week or so ago. If something is really hard to achieve, be aware that you're going to have different quality dynamics than something that's easy. And a second consideration for the project manager's standpoint is, what flexibility do you have? If you get down later in the project, and as someone said about cutting scope, if you're running into trouble in terms of completion, do you have any flexibility to cut those requirements? So that gets us to dynamics, and we'll spend a bit of time on that. First, a slightly different, more elaborate definition of quality in terms of rework. And this ties back to what I think Eric did in one of his lectures on change. Quality defects are potential and actual rework on the project. And these are the definitions that I think Eric gave you, at least he used to. Change, he defined, and this comes from some work by Clarkson and others, and this led to a number of different SDM theses on related topic here. Emergent change is rework needed to reach an initially defined standard in the product. This is what we call quality thus far. Initiated change comes from someplace else. You know, I want this product to do something different. It's not a result of an error. Error is the creation of a problem which leads to an emergent change. And rework is fixing that. Design for quality primarily deals with emergent change. And I think going back to lecture SE13, where you talked about change, I think he showed you some diagrams that I will argue came from our examples of emergent change, Eric was talking mostly about initiated change and what that had to, what were the implications for that for system engineering. Yeah?
Just a question on semantics. So then, if you have initiated change, do you call the responding effort rework, or do you call it something else?
I would call it something else. And I think Eric would agree with me. Many projects, I think, might be take an existing product and adapt it for a different situation. And I would argue that what you think you need to do to adapt it should be part of your scope. You should be able to plan that. You may not, there may be uncertainties, like we said before, which might then lead to emergent change. But at the beginning of the project, the initiated change ought to be, I think, a part of your plan. But I'm happy to hear what other people think. That's the way we have always treated in our modeling. Why does this matter? And Eric showed you this diagram, I think, right? Where he had some ripples, I call it a left ripple and a right ripple. Low, relatively small, but continuous rework. It peaked here, it peaks early in the project. This peaks late in the project. I think a left ripple is more a result of initiated change in Eric's jargon. Then he had a blossom. and he had an avalanche. So why does this matter? A rework blossom is going to cost a lot more, and if you have limited resources, as I've shown here, you're going to finish late. And a blossom can easily turn into an avalanche, particularly if you have a lot of air propagation and a lot of firefighting, as we'll see. And schedule pressures can cause you to ship a product with a delivered quality that is less than one. Yes?
Why is it saying a blossom can easily turn into an avalanche if resources are added? Isn't that counterintuitive?
Well, think back to our workshop in system dynamics and IAP, where you had to add a lot of resources in the project. What happened? Old Brooks' Law stuff, right? There were feedbacks that potentially create additional problems because you add people, productivity goes down. So you're falling further behind, you add more people. If you kept doing that over and over again, you get these kinds of situations. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just arguing because the first point says you will finish later because you have limited resources, right?
Yeah.
And then the second point is like if you add more resources, you'll also finish later. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In fact, we've seen that on many of our modeling projects where adding people made it worse. You finished sooner if you didn't. Because of all of the feedbacks, and particularly the feedback that says as you add people and split things in half and partition work and don't do coordination, you get more errors. And you get more errors, then you've got to discover them and rework them. And when you're reworking them, you make some more errors. And so that tends to push out that response, and if you then keep adding more resources, you can potentially get these avalanches. How can we manage?
Can I add something to that? Actually?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so I think part of it too, Mo, is that like the learning curve implicit to added resources, particularly like human resources, right? So we talked about learning curves earlier on, but you can't just assume necessarily that like adding resources later in the project, they're already gonna understand the problems and sort of really like interest you, right? It's like admire the problem early, but then when you add resources later, like they don't really understand.
Great. Yes, excellent job. Or Shane?
Yeah, if I may ask a question. So are those names defined afterwards? Like for example, I'm wondering how can you tell if that's a red ripple, or if that's a blossom, or if that's becoming an avalanche?
Well, I guess you can't tell if it's an avalanche until you're done. So these were names that this Clarkson set of people came up with to describe some generic rework patterns. And as we'll see, Eric showed you these. These, in fact, are emergent change. They will rework from problems in the project, not from initiated change. And I showed you some of these back in December, where you had, this was the B-2 bomber, and you saw, in this case, I'd argue it's an avalanche. You can see all the rework out here. And this was an automobile, a Jaguar. And you can see the rework here. So these patterns do happen and are important. So What drives these dynamics? And just a reminder about using models. Models, to me, are two things. One, they're diagrams. They help us put down on paper and communicate in some way our mental models. They allow us to look at them as a team and discuss them and brainstorm about what we would do. And then there's, of course, formal quantitative models that allow us to verify our mental models, forecast performance, and design the project. So we're going to use some diagram models using system dynamics today to talk about quality dynamics. When you actually start modeling quantitatively, you will see that different modeling approaches, partly because of the nature of the approach, but also because of the purpose of the model, will consider in their dynamics some or perhaps all of the qualitative quality dynamics that we are going to discuss today. So let's take a look back. Remember in December I talked about this is one model, and Brian too, a network diagram. And we talked about how you would represent errors. You know, you have a fraction correct, a quality. And that creates an error, and that might propagate downstream. And we talked about the complexity of representing that. Where do you go back and do another task three and so forth? And we, you know, a network diagram just isn't set up to handle discussions of rework. Yes?
You have a couple of hands.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, thank you. Jonas?
Thank you. Well, thank you for whoever pointed out that I have my hand up. So I have a quick question. You mentioned that there is, especially in the patterns that are emerging in the project dynamic, you said that if I don't add the people, then I will get a different pattern. If I add the people, that will result in a different pattern. How do you check for counterfactuals with your models? Because technically, once the project is done, you've made the decisions that you've made, and you're looking at something that has already happened. So how do you go back and then say, well, hadn't I done this, what would have been the result? So you can only do that post completion, if you like. So how do you resolve that counterfactual analysis?
Right. So you can only do it on real data after the fact. In fact, when we talk about postmortems later in the lecture, that's one of the key things we'll talk about. But once you're comfortable with a quantitative model, you can do like Brian suggests in project design. So suppose I add people. What is that going to do? Suppose I don't add anyone. What is that going to do? Suppose I add halfway in between, much like I think you did in January. So once you have a model, a quantitative model that you're comfortable with, you can explore some of these options in the middle of a project or at the beginning of a project. Now, once you get done, I think that helps you add to a database that helps you build confidence that the quantitative model you're using is a good way to make those project design decisions.
Well, I guess my biggest question is the rework that emerges is an unknown unknown, because if we knew about it, we could plan for it. Now, when we add people into the project, our model is calibrated under a set of assumptions. It can extrapolate to some extent, but to make the decision based on or to extrapolate into the future, or to extrapolate into the realm of the unknown, if you like, where you have no idea how the addition of the resources is going to translate to the project. How do you, I guess that's my biggest problem, how do you make sure that you have the confidence in the model to even be able to say that, yes, I trust the prediction? Because there is no way for me to validate and go back and recreate this project from scratch.
Right. So can we come back to that as we're going through today? Because I
sure.
think I'm going to try and answer that. Michael?
Thank you, Jim. Maybe you will also try to address my question was about, is about whether you already consider at the beginning of your model if your rework is about the quality or is it related to the change of your requirements of the scope? How do you usually handle this?
Okay, so that's those are the two sources of rework or change that we just discussed a few minutes ago. Emergent change versus initiated change. And all the stuff I'm talking about in these dynamics apply to emergent change. I think initiated change can be, at least in the project plan, can be handled, as I said, through scope. So we'll raise these questions again as we go along if it doesn't become clear. So we talked about this, and then we talked about how there might be an aggregate view that's different than this detailed network view that might be easier for discussing things like rework and undiscovered rework. And we came up with this diagram that I call the work progress and rework cycle back in December. And what you saw was there's original work to do that's all these things. You work on them. Some of them are right and some of them are wrong. This is the work quality component. If work quality is one, everything is right, then everything goes to work done. If some of it has errors, then it flows to undiscovered rework, those errors that are later discovered, and we have to rework them. You can make errors on that rework, which leads to this, why it's called the rework cycle. And so this is a aggregate view of a project, a different model. But I think this one helps us facilitate discussion of quality dynamics. So we're going to use this modified version of it for our discussion today. This is the top part is all the same. The only difference is that when we discover rework, we have a choice to make. And this is a key part of some of Brian's modeling in Teamport. What are you going to do when you identify rework? Are you going to fix it? Or can you somehow defer it? Maybe you can defer it to later in the project. Maybe you can ignore it. Maybe you can defer it to the next project, but there are choices to be made here. And so that's a key part of some of Brian's modeling is this choice here and some social science research. So the key factor here is fraction of work correct. What are the factors that impact dynamics? And as we'll see, just like Eric talked about for technical change, there are triggers and there are, he called them initiators. I sometimes call them triggers. And then there are amplifiers. But these that we're talking about in project management, while some of them are due to technical factors, a lot of them are due to organizational and process and people factors, especially some of the factors that drive making mistakes and then propagating, amplifying those mistakes. So it all gets started up here. And that depends on as we discussed before, what's our scope? What are we trying to do? What are our requirements? How innovative is the project? What's our technology ready to sell? What's our development process? What are the capabilities we need to produce this relative to the people we have? Those are the things that drive productivity and the potential for rework. Right? If we have a project that's way out there, something we've never done before, a huge technology leap, shouldn't we expect that we're going to make a lot more mistakes than on one that we've done 10 or 15 times before? So another factor is how quickly we can discover rework. And if you're taking data on a project, this is typically the data you have. You don't have data on undiscovered rework. You don't have data on what I call fraction correct. You only typically have data on rework discovery. And you might have data on how much rework you decide to are the backlog. So another factor that affects dynamics, therefore, is how you handle exceptions. The more exceptions you push into rework, the more you get these potential leads for these cycles. To the extent you can shunt them aside, you have less chance for propagation of dynamics downstream. Now, but that affects your delivered grade and potentially quality. So there's a decision there. What flexibility do you have? And when you decide to deliver, what's the quality at delivery? Well, everything in these bottom boxes is potential rework to meet the original scope objectives. So anything that's in here means that your quality at delivery is less than one. Now you may make decisions to do that because cost and or schedule may be more important than the requirements of the scope or the delivered quality, but you should be aware that that's what you're doing. Now, it may also be that you can't cut requirements and so forth, and you need to make sure that you have adequate schedule and budget. So let's dig deeper into these. Making mistakes, this is the trigger, the initiator of all quality dynamics. There are normal mistakes from skill level, experience level, capability, what you have versus what you need, both for individuals and teams. Availability of information, how much effort you do on front end work, and so on. Then there are triggers related to what are sometimes known as known unknowns. You make assumptions about technology. You hope they work, but they may not. You make assumptions about the rate of capability development and learning. But again, that's an assumption, and so on. Assumptions about customer requirements. Maybe you're implementing a new process, and it takes longer to get up to speed on it than you hoped. These are all things that cause fraction of work correct, work quality, to be less than one, to trigger dynamics. Ultimately influenced by our scope decisions. Then there are amplifiers. One of the most important amplifiers is one I call error propagation. If you make mistakes, if you make assumptions about technology and they don't prove out until you discover that, or until you can discover it, say by testing maybe, you're going to keep building that error into downstream work products. The downstream work products may have been done correctly, but they're built on information or assumptions that isn't correct. And therefore, they contain an error in the sense they need to be reworked. So this is a key one. Another one is one Brian has talked about a lot, coordination. When you do have to do rework, you need to spend time coordinating between the, or potentially between the upstream creator of their rework and the downstream discoverer. And if you provide that attention, that time, that takes away from current work. So productivity goes down. But if you do that, you're less likely to make errors. If you don't provide the time, the coordination, you're likely to make mistakes in fixing the rework. So these, as we talked about in December, are reinforcing feedbacks. And then as you get behind and you decide you need to add more resources, you can bring on staff, but we talked about all of the dynamics that those create in terms of experience dilution, maybe working overtime and generating a lot of fatigue, having partition tasks. These are all things that drive down productivity and or cause work quality, fraction correct, to not improve as fast as we would have hoped because we continue to make errors. Does that make sense? Yes.
Have you looked at this at all with bringing in like external resources versus internal resources, like experts versus non, like, I don't know, I'm just kind of curious how that plays into some of these dynamics.
Yeah.
Or if you've modeled this.
Certainly on different projects, things that you could do is bring in a different outside contractor or something that might be an expert on that. And those have its pros and cons too. You know, somebody from your team has to coordinate, and there needs to be more overhead related to that than otherwise. So there, for any of these things, there are pros and cons, and you just have to model and try and quantify what those pros and cons are to see if they work better than what you're doing. Yes, thanks.
Thanks, Jim. I'm not an expert in system dynamics, but I was wondering if there's like a point of diminishing returns where it takes a lot of effort to build this. Do you have like a rule of thumb or some kind of approach you take to try to capture and correctly model enough of these processes as opposed to just trying to capture every single potential possibility?
I think the things we've been talking about are the ones that are important. The hard part is deciding the level of what level of detail you need to capture adequately the project. And this was getting partly back to what Brian talked about in the very first class when he talked about models and detail complexity versus dynamic complexity. System dynamics models would typically have all of these dynamic complexity and focus on feedback loops, whereas agile-based models like Teamport tend to have more detail regarding phases of work and tasks, but less of these feedbacks. And I think you can only you can only make an intuitive judgment beforehand which is the better way to go. Most of the system dynamics models, or a lot of the system dynamics models, get started on cost overrun claims, particularly for the military, but also on large civil construction projects. And there, all of these feedbacks are extremely important in determining how you went from a situation that was you know, maybe small, what the owner thought was a small set of changes to vast overruns. And so getting, capturing these amplifying feedback loops was important. But it's less useful, as I'm sure you thought about when you did your projects, for trying to design a detailed project with 10 or 20 phases of work and so forth. And particularly where, at this point, the feedbacks haven't played themselves out. Okay. And so, let me just quickly walk through this. I talked about amplification. This is how it would play out in a mental model simulation. At the beginning of a project, we have some things that go wrong and cause rework, errors. They cause errors. I illustrated that here. Something at the beginning of the project, we had to make some assumptions about technology. That those assumptions, as we'll see, turn out to be wrong, and therefore we'll have to fix them again. But then, as we proceed with the project, yes, we're no longer doing this work, but the undiscovered rework in these tasks gets propagated to downstream work. And so you see there are errors caused by the propagation of these initial errors to downstream tasks. And then, as we discover that rework, we realize we have to do some coordination. And we don't do it all, so we get an impact from coordination. And then finally, we might realize we're behind, and so we need to add staff. And we get a firefighting increase later in the project. And so, a small change here, with nothing else happening, creates all of this amplification downstream to cause the project to cost a lot more than it initially did. So one of the key concepts here is the idea that the size of this trigger is critical. If this trigger were a trivial thing, these dynamics wouldn't matter. Or if this trigger were much bigger, they'd even be worse, particularly when you had to add staff later in. So thinking about this, what would make a big trigger versus a little trigger? I sometimes think about it in terms of the type of project. If you have a really novel project, lots of new stuff and TRLs that are low, I would argue you're going to get bigger triggers than if you're on a mature project that you're doing the 10th or 15th, and it's just a question of applying things you've done over and over again, and the only real mistakes are perhaps from people who are inexperienced, but not from knowledge of technology and stuff, and so you have small triggers. Yes?
So this is emergent change, right?
Emergent change, yes.
So if the change is triggered early on, isn't that a good thing rather than this happening later in the project, right?
If it's an initiated change and the change you know is coming, because it's initiated, you know you're going to change these things, and therefore you can design your project to deal with that. If this change is unknown, you don't know what this is going to be. You know, before the project and in retrospect, you know something like this is going to happen. You just don't know exactly what it's going to be. So this becomes undiscovered, and while it's undiscovered, it can build to downstream work products until you get to the point in your project when you can test that concept that you had earlier.
I guess what I'm saying is, how would you have a big emergent change if you are early on in the project, right?
Remember this, it's undiscovered reward. What I mean is, suppose it's what do you do early in the project? You're making assumptions about technology and what's going to happen. So you make an assumption, this is going to work.
Yeah. I guess from a project.
But that assumption was wrong, so that's why you get this. You don't know that assumption is wrong. You only discover that assumption way out here. This is where rework is coming in. So you make the error here, but you only discover it way out here, and all of the propagated errors that go along with it. So that's why this is the trigger. And on a lot of projects, I think you can say, yeah, I know something like this is going to happen. If you collect data on enough projects like we have, you can know that the amount of rework on a project is going to be, 25%, 50%. You just don't know exactly where it's going to be. And that's what this means. Okay? And because of that, generate this kind of rework, you only discover this, and you end up in a late. And I'm going to skip over this, and we'll look at this in a couple of next week when we look at how resource control works. So that's my spiel on quality dynamics. I only wanted to add to that a model here, this model, can produce any of these rework propagation patterns depending upon your input assumptions. And I think that's an interesting area of research if anyone is interested. So all of the things we've talked about, I think, are based on mental models and project models that came from me, that came from Brian, that came from students here as we've talked about these dynamics over the years. But other social scientists have also done research on what affects quality. And I've listed some of the key things here that came out of Brian's class, EM425, and you can read through some of these if you'd like. Organization structure, resource capability, and utilization influence this trigger. Allocation roles may influence how these things affect productivity and quality and experience of teams we talked about. So there's social science research that also backs up some of these dynamics that we've been talking about. So, almost ready to take a break. What I'd like to do is now to spend a little bit of time talking about what we call project design for quality. From the customer's perspective, how you achieve a high delivered quality isn't going to matter, may not matter. But it can have a significant impact on cost and schedule. I think, as I argued before, the type of project and the available staff makes a difference. Novel versus mature products are going to generate different triggers. If you have mostly experienced staff versus mostly inexperienced, or if you've developed a capability versus not, you're going to get different triggers. So your strategy for dealing with quality potential problems may differ depending upon the project. So having had this discussion with the mental model, where are the leverage points here? Where can we do something that is going to improve our project quality dynamics. And before I do this, let me just make, since Eric talked about F18, and this is a diagram. This is a diagram. Sometimes people ask, is it worth building a model? Well, I think it is, but models can be expensive. But you can learn a lot about the dynamics just by studying a diagram. And Eric talked about the F-18 program that was delivered ahead of schedule, within cost, and under weight. Last SE, which was it in lecture 13, I-3, I think he called it. Just so happens that there was a system dynamics model also of this project. And this is a quote from the project manager at Northrop Grumman. And the important points I highlighted in red, we cut our rework effort to 1/4 of what they expected. People asked how. He'd take them to his office. There was a model diagram he kept on the wall, much like the one I showed you before. And so these are the things he cited in a letter to the company I used to work for. Model diagram, integrated product teams, and so forth. So I hope that even if you never build a model again, that the ideas that are here will help you have better discussions of project design that take these factors into account. So where are the leverage points? What are the initiators? Scope. There are decisions here that influence as a trigger initiator. What can you do to get it right the first time? These are the two key initiators. Where are the amplifiers? Well, you want to minimize rework cycling, right? And then you want to reduce error propagation. Those are leverage points. In order to reduce error propagation, what do? Could be some process changes. Maybe you should adopt an iterative or spiral approach rather than a waterfall. How do you discover rework as soon as possible? The sooner you discover rework, the less error propagation. The leverage point is allocating time for coordination. And when you can't cut scope or improve initial capabilities, another leverage point is making sure you have adequate budget. So what we're going to do having identified these leverage points, what I want you to do is we'll take a break and have a breakout. All is one, let's say, 15-minute block. What I'd like you to do is turn to your neighbor, and I think Ryan's going to put the remote people in breakout groups. And I'd like you to discuss what you would do in some of these, fill out some of these boxes. What should you do, or what do you do to improve quality? Either to reduce the initiation of errors or reduce the amplification. So, essentially fill out these, whatever of these that you think you have something to say about, and we'll get together at, let's say, 12:15 or 12:13, 12:17, and see what you do in your organizations. So, any questions before we... So, take a break if you desire at the beginning or at the end. We'll set people in breakout groups in the distance and turn to your neighbor.
break first?
Good, man. How you doing?
Yo, did you go to that?
Oh, yeah, I did. I mean, it was, I was, like, going to mention it again, but I had a suspicion that it was going to be very casual. Yeah, I know. It was just, like, pretty low-key.
I went to New Orleans.
Oh, how was it?
Shit show.
Have you been before?
I was there in 2018. It wasn't as bad.
Yeah.
It's
bad as in, like, went hard? What do you mean by bad?
No, it was, like, horrible. Yeah.
Like, it's a rough...
Bad.
Shit. I didn't realize that.
It feels like I'm inside of a dark web. I swear to God, man.
It's like the dredges of the... I mean, you're on, like, around Bourbon Street and all that project, yeah. Right? Yeah. I feel like I've heard the other areas are getting
what
better.
What other areas?
No, that's what I mean. There's these, like, the resident, like, the more, like, outside the downtown areas, I guess.
But it's destroyed. It's abandoned houses after the...
Yeah. That's tough, man. That's tough. Yeah, I remember liking New Orleans. I mean, like, it's such an interesting place. But, yeah, it's sad that it's not, like, kept up quality like that.
Yeah.
But, yeah. No, it was good.
Music became horrible. Like, I remember 2018. Anywhere you listen to nice jazz.
Yeah. Oh, it's super touristy also, right? I feel like it's gotten more and more popular.
But I went to the Lakers game.
Oh, cool. That's awesome. That's awesome. All
probably all stinky.
Oh, okay. I was thinking of the people.
Should we look at this thing? Oh, it's gone. I was just figuring out what to do there. So, let's see.
What kind of notebook app do you use?
Notability.
Notability?
Yeah, well, that's usually for handwriting. I like for when I'm handwriting, Notability. Yeah, it's nice. Yeah. Kind of hard to read, that's fine. So yellow is scope decisions. Okay, so one is scope decisions. What are the other ones? Green is, no, there's no green. Purple is adequate schedule. Right. And budget. Getting it right first time, minimize errors, okay. So, okay. I guess the purple one is like, purple one is kind of like, I guess agile kind of makes sense for that, because it's like, like getting it right the first time, so like you try to reduce your quality cycle, like your quality checks, so you do it more frequently, minimize errors on the rework, so you're checking that, like just having smaller loops
again and again.
Yeah, exactly, like doing it repetitively and smaller. That's that's something in the purple, I guess, that I would do. Reduce error propagation is red. And discover ASAP. Reduce. So that's. I don't know.
Maybe one of the iteration is getting. Because I'm working for government.
Yeah.
There are companies who are working outside of the government.
Okay.
They have a lot of information about the current situation or problem. And for us, it's important whether what we are thinking about, the policy, is effective to solve that problem or not.
Yeah, so I see.
First, we try to gather a lot of information and we make an assumption. Mm-hmm. And, it is good whether that assumption can be helpful for them to reduce, to solve the problem.
Gotcha.
So this is one of them.
Yeah, that's like a full, yeah. With external parties, that makes it especially kind of difficult, right, or important, I guess. Interesting. Yeah, that's like when you're like, do you see rework in that cycle? Like when you're working with, yeah, like how does that, I'm curious how that, what does that like look like? Are you working with, so when you're working with like, so you're working for the government, you're working with external parties, like are you checking to see like what the policy impacts are? Is that what it is? Okay.
Yes. And and sometimes we do rework.
I see. Okay. I see. Interesting. What's an example of like the rework that has to happen? I'm just curious.
Based on the information I gathered from the startups.
Okay. Okay.
Startups in an area. I talked with Tokyo, what we can do. And what we can do is limited because of the constraints of money, these kind of things. We made our best plan, but I was not sure if it's work or not.
I see. So there's like, so investments are actually one of the things you're saying. Yeah, like where the money is.
So in that case, we try to get additional budget
to
explore other possibilities.
Like these startups might not actually solve the problem, like, or like this investment might not like actually be successful, kind of thing. Do you like when the investment is it like you say like maybe the investment isn't going to be successful, or it's because you need more money to actually fulfill like for the startup to be successful? Interesting. Wow. Yeah, that's pretty complicated dynamic.
I can't know it exactly, if I can guess it. But what happens if I knew this? What would it allow me to do? Well, one thing it would allow you to do is simulate all of this and come up with a cost and schedule that's feasible, that takes into account the amount of emergent change that comes out of this and all of the dynamics. You can also ask, well, what happens if it's less? What happens if it's a lot more? And if you have that information, then you've got to decide what's going to be my strategy. If I settle on this, is that going to be my cost and schedule? Or am I going to try for a more aggressive cost and schedule and hope for the best? So having a model can help you identify not only just the dynamics, but the consequences of those. Okay, so what are some of you do to improve quality on your projects? And I'll try and type into some of these boxes you have along.
Yes. So in some of my experiences for scope decision related, we did technical requirements definition, like controlling the technical requirements. For any changes, we have a memo signed by the parties involved or a technical change approvals, including the feasibility studies, to kind of have any quality issues on the scope decisions.
Scope decisions and changes. Okay, Emmanuel? And then I'll come in.
Yeah, a good exercise we perform what we call program integration workshop, meaning we bring product engineering, program management, quality in one room and try to align the scope when we have the requirements from the production systems.
Okay.
So that particular workshop are very big helpful in order to have alignment between the teams.
And I just say, bring together everyone.
Yeah, program integration workshop is what we call it, PIWs.
To determine. Somebody in here, yeah?
So from our discussion, we mentioned that implementing a quality management system would be a good idea to improve the process, because in that way you will have standard operating procedures, and in that way you will improve the quality of the system or the work that you will be doing.
Okay, so where do you think that affects most, or reducing errors, getting it right the first time?
I think it would be reducing errors.
Okay, so implement quality management system?
Yes, such as ISO 9001 and all of those that are industry standards.
Yes, I work for government, so my case is a little bit different from technical thing, but we usually get feedback from the beneficiary before deciding the policy. So this is about the reducing the...
Feedback from the client, whoever the client may be.
Yeah.
Okay.
One of the things that we came up with is matching scope with the company or the organization's capability. So don't be, don't have a scope that doesn't match what the staff's experience or knowledge is, that you're going to get stuck somewhere in the future, which will add new work to your project. Right, and that's a key insight, I guess. But the other thing we have to consider, if you're ever going to develop capabilities, you're going to have a stretch somewhere. And so maybe the corollary to that is make sure that the stretch is either doable without too much difficulty. Too much difficulty, but it's doable, and or you have adequate schedule and budget to get up the learning curve for the one you choose. Let me go to Dax.
Yes, I'm a systems engineer on a weapons production project, so getting it right the first time and minimizing errors is important, and we try to do that by trying to get early verification of test and acceptance criteria on early fabrication and trying to course correct as soon as possible if there's errors.
When we work in global or multinational teams, we consider local holidays and build extra buffers.
We just make this more general. Consider local constraints.
Yeah.
How does that?
Thank you.
Matthew?
Yeah, so we had a few that I've already been mentioned, but one that kind of goes along with identifying things early is making sure that everybody that is working on the project is properly trained, so executing their work correctly right away.
For, I think this goes under adequate schedule. Sometimes I think it's overlooked a lot of the complexity of the project and the time for coordination. So making sure that you align your complexity with the amount, location of the groups, right, that need to work together and incorporating that in the schedule. The other thing is like making sure you have enough time to do a thorough stakeholder analysis.
On your front end, enough time, time to do stakeholder. And anything related to that, I guess, a lot in here.
So my third one is IPTs. So if there's a large issue that occurs within an IPT, they'll usually assign a project manager to it. And if it's a larger issue that goes across IPTs, and they'll use a program manager. So I think that can really help with making sure there's an adequate schedule and budget. And if it seems like it's too big, the program manager can communicate to executives to look for additional resources.
Okay, so where would you put that? In budget?
So I would say it would be in budget because they would be the liaison between the engineering teams and leadership that makes financial decisions.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Yeah. So we do a lot of root cause analysis. So especially during periods of a lot of rework deferred. So in a sense, we provide the feedback from the stock of rework deferred to adapt the rate of work to minimize error propagation.
Can I say incorporate, or if I can spell, cause analysis on future projects? So in this project, we want to incorporate what we learned on the last projects. Bernardo?
Yeah, on a similar manner, like, we usually, in my organization, utilize the knowledge we have from previous projects, and every established team has kind of a ratio of how much rework they have performed in the past. So we account for the rework ratio, like create a buffer, so that team can tackle all the rework as soon as possible and reduce the error propagation. So we account on budget for that buffer.
Anybody have anything they're dying to say before we move on?
For minimizing errors, so it'd be useful and to avoid complexity for the system itself, system architecture and project architecture, we will minimize the complexity, for example, by reducing interfaces.
Okay, one more. Wow.
Designing failure modes so you can basically evaluate every possibility before it occurs. So on doing it right the first time, I would say design failure modes during the system development.
Design field?
Failure modes.
Oh,
designing failure modes.
Okay.
So it can be designed for manufacturing, designed for assembly, or designed for a liability. You basically visualize every failure scenario before you do any
okay.
Discourse.
Got it. Okay. Good. Lots of good ideas. And these would be probably characteristics of what we might, if you did all or most of these things, you'd be organization that designs for quality. Quality first. Go back to the slideshow. Right here. Okay. What happened? I missed something. aggressive cost schedule building strategy differ from what we talked about in the last slide? What would you do differently if you were really concerned with cost schedule and that was your top priority? What kinds of things would you do that might be different than what you would do if you were designed for quality first?
I was just going to say I would focus on the novelty a little bit more. So if I wouldn't want to do a lot of novel projects if cost and schedule is a big concern for me, because you would always almost expect delays and you expect high costs and never stick in the budget. So that's
okay.
The first thing that I would think about.
That's what you should do. Is that what a cost schedule driven firefighting organization does?
Defer a lot of rework.
They defer a lot of rework, right. They hide it. You know, if your cost and schedule is the most important thing, you certainly don't want to come up and tell your managers, I've discovered some rework. You don't do that until you've got it fixed, usually. And you also, to avoid shooting, getting shot as a messenger. Yes, what else?
Relax the acceptance criteria.
Relax acceptance criteria. Yeah, get it out the door.
You may have a smaller team, so no project manager or assistant designer or something like that, but then, so less staff at the beginning, but then it causes usually unplanned work during development.
Okay. Abhay?
So one strategy we are currently implementing at the Weapons Directorate to relax the acceptance criteria, what Sai mentioned, is to qualify where we can compromise the design for non-critical parts of the system. And that has been working out well for us so far.
Okay. Michael, and then we'll come back to class.
Usually we make the entire quality plan, we optimize process planning, define the KPIs, regions where we also have always a backup mitigation plan, so where we can swiftly move forward.
Okay. Yeah.
I guess more proactively, you can focus on the minimum scope. I don't know if this is quality first, but if you're trying to be cost checker focused, you can focus on maybe if you've got different grades of your product, pick the lowest grades.
Right. Okay. One more, Dave, and then.
Yeah, we make decisions that will have negative impacts on other parts of the business in order to ship the one product.
What's best for the one project may not be best for the rest, and Brian will come back to that when he talks about project portfolio. So I listed on this slide some of the things that have come up in prior years. Lean staffing and aggressive targets. So you tend to skip things that are seemingly unnecessary or not completely as necessary. You tend to see high rework, as you said. Lower priority to coordination. Why work with somebody else? I got to get my job done. But that creates more errors. Rewarding heroic behavior in firefighting. With that, causes, though, are some other feedbacks between projects. Unnecessary firefighting causes unplanned resources being allocated to this project. I think if a project is in trouble and you got to crash it, you bring in resources to try and get it done. And what kinds of feedbacks does that create? Often those resources, and this is some work that Nelson Repenning at the Sloan School has done, if you're interested in that, the resources don't devote time from doing front-end work on other projects or from working on other projects as planned. So what does that do to the other project? That puts them behind from the start. So they're going to end up in a firefighting situation when they get later. Or you spend insufficient time and resources to really solve a problem, or you don't put everything in that you said you were, and you ship it either with rework or with not meeting the requirements you specs you hoped. And what does that mean? That when the customer gets it, that's going to come back to you, and you're going to have to spend the resources later taking it away from another project. So what you see is that firefighting behavior in the face of limited resources tends to perpetuate itself from project to projects. Okay. Again, Nelson McPenning at Sloan School has done a lot of work on that. And so that's why I drew this before. Firefighting can create an earlier finish, but it can cause quality problems and knock on to other projects. Now, an aggressive strategy can work if there isn't much initial errors. So an aggressive strategy may be beneficial on mature products, but not on, let's say, novel projects, in my view. Okay, so let me next give you an example. This is, Brian asked me where I got this picture. This somebody gave it to, well, P-Shield project gave it to me. It's kind of a weird picture, but P-Shield was an air defense system developed by Hughes Aircraft before they were acquired by Raytheon for Saudi Arabia. It was primarily a software system executed in a waterfall approach, and a system dynamics model was used on it for bid support and risk assessment, project design for quality, and I'll give you some examples of what that meant, and mid-project forecasting and corrections. And after we were done, and I think we touched on this before, post-project learning, what did we learn from having done and applied some of these ideas to the P-Shield project? And I showed you this diagram at the beginning, back in December, and I showed you that this was, I said this was, this was the approximate original plan, and this was an actual project of command and control system that was done on in the 80s. This was chosen in 90. I shifted it out here. P-Shield had this time pattern. What could they do to avoid this massive overrun? So the problem was, this was the actual on the last command and control system. This was the original plan on that system, and that was a disaster. How could they avoid it? Boeing had this contract before Hughes, and it was canceled for non-performance. The first Gulf War, came along. And another aspect of the project was that there was a $50 million bonus provided by the Air Force and the Saudis for on-time delivery. And Hughes made the policy decision to share whatever bonus there was completely with staff on the project. So you can imagine what that's like, the motivation. So what happened on P-Shield? There were a lot of things done on P-Shield for the first time that were stimulated by simulations of the model trying to improve quality. They delayed the ramp-up of design staff in order to do an assessment of what they call liftability, sort of a front-end system engineering analysis of, you know, here's all this code we have on the prior project and on other command and control systems, how much of that is really usable? In the past, they would have just charged ahead and assumed something. They started integrated product teams. That's no longer a new thing. But back in the 90s, when this project was done, this was the first one that was done within this division of Hughes. So it was a new process, but it was also one that they didn't really know much about how to implement. They delayed the start of downstream phases relative to standard practice. In other words, there was less overlap, say, between design and code and test. And finally, they delayed the roll-up of staff at the end of each phase of work with any extra staff assigned to a quality review in an effort to try and reduce error propagation and speed rework discovery. These are all new things that were done. And if you look at that list, you can see, and this is typical, these are actions that seemingly reduced perceived progress. You know, we slowed things down in terms of fraction reported complete and increased short-term costs. The model is used to assess the cost effectiveness of those actions and to convince that they were wise to do in spite of what we call this worse before better dynamics. Yeah, perceived progress did slow down. You know, if you're delaying the startup of the downstream phase, you're behind schedule, right? But as it turns out, it was a major success. This was the prior command and control, this was P-Shield. And they got a big, says $50 million. There's a quote from Chuck Sutherland, who was the P-Shield program manager, about the use of the simulation model, if you're interested. So after P-Shield, Hughes asked us, well, why did this work so well? And what can we do to make sure our next software projects do the same? And so they were particularly interested in, if this is the past program and this is P-Shield, how much of it was due to just different scope and requirements? How much of it was due to different external conditions? The past program was done during the 80s, during Reagan's defense buildup, and there were severe shortages of engineers and suppliers in general. So the external environment for the past program was much more severe than for P-Shield. But there were also, as I noted, changes in policies and processes. So how do we determine this? Well, basically what we did was we built, well, we had the simulation model. We calibrated that model, the same model, with the only difference being scope, external conditions, and policies. Simulated those and compared it to make sure that it matched the data. And you can see it pretty well. And then we took the model of the past program and removed things. We removed all of the external differences and made them the same as what happened on P-Shield. So the availability of vendors and hiring conditions were improved from what was happened in the past program to what happened on P-Shield. Lower scope was on P-Shield. You simulate that, you see that almost half of the difference goes away. Then we had to impose the P-Shield schedules on P-Shield. When you do that, what you saw is that the cost went back up because it was a more aggressive schedule. Then we removed the management changes. What happens if, we didn't remove them, we added them. We said delay the start of design, delay or less overlapping phases, don't roll off staff at the end of the phase. We did all those things on this program, and you get down to the P-Shield performance. And so the bottom line is that of the difference in cost and schedule, more than half of it was due to things that are free, in a sense, but are focused on quality. Half, a little under half, was due to external conditions. And so this was to Hughes, this was a significant insight, that this was really worth doing these things, even though it slowed perceived progress. So that is an example of using a model for lessons learned in a postmortem. That's essentially what we did, a postmortem on actually, it says two projects there in the paper. There's actually three projects. So I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about lessons learned in postmortems. Root causes, I think someone said before. The traditional approach is to do what's set up here. Yes?
Sorry, Jim, I was just curious. Did your model incorporate removing the $50 million bonus?
Yes, we did do that. The government didn't want to hear that. They have to do that in future projects. But yes, the morale improvement had a significant impact as well. So there's a traditional approach. This is covered really well in all of the standard textbooks and in PM POC. I don't want to go over it. Tied back to charters that you saw in PM1. And here's an example of a project variance report. This is all, I think, relatively straightforward and, as I said, covered in textbooks. A model-based approach, I think, can be extremely helpful to understand things like what we did on P-Shield. It allows you to understand what really happened on a project in those kinds of categories. What was the initial scope? What were the external conditions? What were the changes you made? And how did each of those contribute to the dynamics and the final cost and schedule? And that information, and along the way, it provides you with information about what was the likely amount of rework, what was the likely work quality, fraction of work correct as you went through the project. And so it gives you information that you couldn't necessarily get from data. So how would this work? Basically, a real project has characteristics, objectives, a scope and plan, and an architecture. And that's the real project. Project data comes from the execution of that project. Each project experiences a unique combination of these characteristics, but also external factors, things that change. Requirements changes, scope growth, supplier problems, disruptions, those affect projects. Management actions, what their quality strategy was, if any. the resource strategy, any control strategy, those all differ. You put those all together, and on the real project, you get some data for project performance. So the question becomes, I think there's a question, how do we assess the contribution of each of these and to specific actions or specific external factors to this performance? So basically, a quantitative model. I'm going to show a system dynamics model, because I think with all of the feedbacks, it's particularly good at this kind of postmortem. You develop the model. You set up the model to represent the project with those characteristics. You put in direct impacts, external, time-based, for external factors that happened, and for any management actions that were taken. And that's what we did on the Peace Shield postmortem. These were different for Peace Shield versus the prior command and control. You then simulate and make sure it matches the data that comes out of that project. This process creates the actual cost of the project, including any the direct and indirect cost of any of these changes, because just like that quality explosion amplification we saw earlier, any changes, plus or minus, create propagating feedbacks that can cause the cost, final cost and schedule to be significantly greater than the direct cost. Then what do? To normalize between projects, you remove the unique aspects. What of these are unique to this project? You take them out. Simulate it again, and this tells you what the project would have cost without these external factors or without the benefit of these management actions. And you can do them individually. I'm just showing this as a group. This is the project would have cost. And that can become part of the database for comparing projects and for learning what are risks, what are good policies. What are good policies under different project characteristics? If it's a novel and complex project versus a mature project, what works? I think a postmortem assessment has a lot of benefits. Building confidence in your quantitative and mental models, providing estimates of direct and indirect impacts of change. These can be risks, as I said, or management changes. Assess what the project would have cost absent any of these changes. And that's not always the same as the plan. Just because you remove everything that happened to the project doesn't mean it's going to cost what you budgeted. On a lot of the claims that we did, we would often be working for the builder. You know, they overran, and they hire us to prove delay and disruption and quantify secondary impact of all the changes that the government or whoever did to them. And we do that, and we remove them all, and it wouldn't come back to what they budgeted or bid. And they were never very happy, but that's, I think, a characteristic of most of our plans, is they're not exactly feasible and produces data. So, going back to what Eric and Brian said, parametric estimating, one of the reasons you may see this widespread is because each of the characteristics of these projects has different external and internal management policies. And so trying to compare this is useful, but until you can remove them, you can determine relative time. So there's a couple summary slides, designed for quality, and something you should might want to consider when you're doing your project presentations, whether or not we're going to talk about design for quality, as well as design for flexibility and other things, when you're doing your project planning on your project. So, I won't get to monitoring and forecasting, maybe by that next week, but that's all for today. I'll see you next week. I'll stay here for a few minutes.
You don't need your food.
Or schedule and budget over quality, because it may turn out that something we thought was necessary won't be necessary after 6 months down the line. It's just a different angle on it.
Yeah.
That would be interesting. Normally, we would say, did something that would be productivity.
Okay. So that could still be baked into the. It sounds like what you're talking about needs to be separately represented.
Right. But also, more on the architecture side. Would you have a requirement that you ended up not needing? You think it just that's sort of the software like, in favor of get it out the door and then worry about rework later, right? That's kind of the fast pace that software is kind of different.
Obviously, then building a power plant,
exactly. That's unlikely to do too much excess work on
it, ship it out the door, and let the customer discover all my
right. But I guess you can bake it in different ways.
Yeah.
No, I'm not. Maybe next year. We'll see. Let's see.
Of course.
Thank you.
Oh my God.
You're going the wrong way. Okay.